So our next speaker is Dmitry Kotov, joint work with John Hopfeld, and he's going to tell us about dense associative memory for pattern recognition.
Hello, everybody. The work that I'm going to present is done in collaboration with John Hopfeld, and it focuses on the relationship between two subfields within the field of neural networks. One subfield is associative memory, and the other one is deep learning. Associative memory is usually defined by an energy function and a dynamical update rule that describes temporal evolution towards one of the attractor states. Each attractor corresponds to one of the memories. For example, in this little simulation shown in this slide, I have designed a very simple model of associative memory that memorized a set of binary images of handwritten digits. We can start from some initial state, like the one that is shown here, and run temporal evolution. You can see that as the computation progresses, I guess you can see it. Yep. As the computation progresses, the associative memory recalls one of the memorized states. And this is the typical task that associative memories are good at. Given an incomplete pattern, like the one that is shown here, associative memory can calculate its completion. In deep learning, people often study feed-forward neural nets, which are typically used for classification. Thus, normally, associative memory models and feed-forward neural nets are designed for solving two very different tasks. Another difference between them is that associative memories are recurrent neural nets, and the neural nets that are used for classification are typically feed-forward. In spite of these differences, when it comes to pattern classification, there is a very simple duality that relates these two models, and I'm going to talk about this duality in my talk. More specifically, we discuss models of associative memory with higher order interactions in the energy function. The energy is given by this formula, and the aim is to look into the computational properties of these models as a function of power n. In this formula, sigma i's are dynamical variables, xi's are memory vectors, capital N is the number of the neurons, and capital K is the number of the memorized patterns. Once the energy is defined, it is straightforward to derive an iterative update rule that leads to the decrease of that energy. The capacities of these models, in cases when memory's xi's are random binary patterns, were extensively studied in the 80s. It was demonstrated that these models make it possible to store a much larger number of memories compared to the quadratic case. More specifically, for the model of associative memory with interaction vertex of power n, the maximum number of patterns that such model can store scales like capital N to the power n minus 1. Again, capital N is the number of the neurons, and little n is the power of the interaction vertex. In the middle of the slide, you can see a cartoon of an energy landscape for a very simple model of associative memory that only has two neurons and three memories. For small values of power n, you can see that the three minima that correspond to the three memories stored by this memory are barely distinguishable, so that associative memory reconstruction algorithm can easily get stuck in undesirable configurations of neurons. In contrast, for large values of n, each memory has a nice basin of attraction around it, so that the associative memory reconstruction algorithm smoothly progresses until one of the memories is perfectly recovered. The goal of our project is to investigate these models in situations when the memory's xi's are continuous variables rather than binary. Another difference between our approach and the standard use of associative memories is that instead of simply embedding the patterns into the pool of memories, for example, by using the standard Hebbian learning rule, we train our nets using a backpropagation algorithm so that the memories are learned iteratively. Now, let me explain how we can do pattern recognition using this system. Consider classification of handwritten digits as an example of the pattern recognition problem. In the left corner of this slide, you can see a typical image from the MNIST dataset, which has 28 by 28 pixels in it. We will rearrange these pixels in one vector of visible neurons that is denoted by VI, which has 784 neurons in it. In addition to these neurons, we will have another 10 neurons that are used for classification. Thus, in total, our net will have 794 neurons. Now, remember in my first slide, I showed you this little simulation, And I told you that associative memories are very good at completing the incomplete patterns. Now we will use exactly the same idea here. We will treat the visible part of this vector as an incomplete pattern, and the label, the 10 classification neurons, as the part of the pattern that needs to be completed. Thus, the calculation of the label will be simply part of the associative memory reconstruction algorithm. More specifically, we initialized our net in a state when all the visible neurons are clumped to the intensities of the pixels, and all the classification neurons are initialized in the off state. Then we update the states of the classification neurons once by holding the visible units fixed, so that the final vector C alpha, which is the output of the network, is used for the final classification decision. The update rule follows from the energy function, which is shown in this slide. Let's take a look at this formula. The expression in the brackets is the scalar product of the vector of activities of the neurons and the memories. The result of that scalar product is transformed using a nonlinear function f of x. From now on, I will use rectified polynomials of power n as these nonlinear functions. As you can see, the energy function, and for that reason the update rule, is defined by a set of parameters, xi's, that I will call memories. And the goal of training is to learn these parameters. Now, let's imagine that the training is complete, so that the network has learned some nice set of weights or memory vectors xi's. The next question that I would like to discuss is the following. What do these memories look like? In other words, what kind of representation of the data have the neural network learned? However, before I address this question, I'd like to take a little digression and talk about theories of pattern recognition in general. In cognitive psychology and neuroscience, there are two extreme views on the theory of pattern recognition. They are feature matching theory and the prototype theory. The feature matching theory is inspired by experiments done by Hubel and Wesel, who discovered the existence of direction selective cells. These are cells that become active only when a certain elementary pattern of activity is present in the stimulus. For example, there are cells in the visual cortex that become active only when an animal sees a horizontal bar. And there are other cells that become active only when a vertical bar is shown. According to the feature matching theory, when a new image is presented, that image is first decomposed into a set of elementary features, which are detected by the feature detector cells. Then the activities of these feature detector cells are sent into higher areas of the brain where there are other cells that detect features of features. And this process continues in a hierarchical way for several steps until the final layer where the classification decision is made. So this is the feature matching theory. The alternative view, the prototype theory, is inspired by experiments done in the 80s by Sosa and McCarthy. And later on, these experiments were replicated by many other people. In particular, in this slide, I'm using illustrations from the paper written by Guy Wallace and collaborators in the Journal of Vision. In this set of experiments, an image of a human face was used as a prototype, from which a set of descendant faces were derived using techniques from computer graphics. In the right corner of this slide, you can see a two-dimensional plane with all these descendant faces arranged on it. And the arrangement is such that the farther the face is from the center, the less similar that face is to the prototype. And the prototype itself is located right in the middle. This entire data set of descendant faces was split into two halves, the familiar faces that are shown in red and the unfamiliar faces that are shown in blue. In the training time, human subjects were presented with some examples of the familiar faces and were asked to memorize them. In the test time, the same human subjects were presented with some examples of the familiar faces, some examples of the unfamiliar faces, and the prototype face itself. And the task was to distinguish the familiar faces from the unfamiliar. The experiments have shown two results. First of all, the human subjects were quite good at distinguishing the familiar faces from the unfamiliar faces. However, they were pretty confident that they had seen the prototype face before, although it had never actually been shown in training time. This is a very surprising result. In psychology, it has a name. It's called the prototype effect. And it motivates the following idea of pattern recognition theory. That perhaps instead of decomposing the input image into a set of elementary features and then matching these features, the image as a whole or as a gestalt can be compared to a set of memorized prototypes. And the classification decision can be made based on the degree of similarity between the presented image and the prototypes. And of course, that degree of similarity should be calculated up to some elementary transformations like rotations or rescalings. Now, the reason why I'm telling you about this is because I'd like to argue that the power of the interaction vertex, this parameter n, is the parameter that regulates the feature-to-prototype transition in the artificial neural nets that we have constructed. As an example, we trained these dense associative memories on the MNIST dataset of handwritten digits. In this slide, you can see 25 randomly chosen memories that this neural network have learned for models with the power of the energy function equal to 2, 3, 20, and 30. Each little square here, like the one highlighted by the green frame, represents the visible part of one memory. And the color code is such that the blue color energetically favors pixels in the off state, the red color energetically favors pixels in the on state, and the white color corresponds to pixels that do not contribute to the energy function. Let's take a look at one of the memories, for example, the one for n equals 2, highlighted by the green frame. As you can see, it looks like a pattern of activity that might be useful for recognizing multiple different digits. Thus, it serves as a feature detector. In contrast, if we look at one of the memories for large n, for n equals 30, it looks like a prototype of a single digit. And in the intermediate range of powers n, we see a gradual transition from features to prototypes. Although the weights that the neural network have learned are very different for different values of power n, the classification accuracy is almost the same. Here you can see the errors that this neural net is making on the MNIST pixel permutation invariant task. Notice that these networks were trained using the plain stochastic gradient descent, so we're not using dropout, adversarial training, or any other form of regularization. In this class of methods, the gold standard result on this task is 1.6%. The reason why I'm showing you these numbers is to convince you that our nets are capable of achieving that result, in spite of operating in a very different computational regime compared to deep neural nets with rectified linear units. Now, how is this all related to feed-forward neural nets? In the left corner of this slide, you can see the simplest example of a feed-forward neural net with one layer of hidden neurons. The activities of the visible neurons, the eyes, are transmitted into the hidden layer using a nonlinear activation function f of x. My notations are such that I denote by a lowercase f of x the activation function of a feedforward neural net, and by an uppercase f of x the energy function of the associative memory models. These two functions are different and they should not be confused. So on the left, we see the feedforward neural net with an activation function lowercase f of x. On the right, we see the model of associative memory that is defined by the energy function capital F of x. It turns out that these two models are doing exactly the same computation, provided that the activation function of the feedforward neural net is equal to the derivative of the energy function. Thus, if the energy function is a rectified polynomial of power n, the corresponding activation function is a rectified polynomial of power n minus 1. So this is the matching rule that allows us to go back and forth between these two models. In this slide, you can see examples of the activation functions that are commonly used in deep learning. They are hyperbolic tangents, the logistic function, and the rectified linear unit. In the dual description, the first two choices correspond to models of associative memory with n equals 1. The rectified linear unit corresponds to the model with n equals 2, which is the standard Hopfield net. In the last, the fourth column of this slide, you can see an unusual activation function, which is a rectified polynomial of a higher degree. In the dual description, it corresponds to dense associative memories with higher order interactions in the energy function. The first three choices in this slide are very common, and the last one is almost never used, and we know little about it. However, now since we have the duality in our hands, we know something about the computational properties of these functions. In particular, we know that if we pick a sufficiently large power of this activation function, then the corresponding feedforward neural net will learn prototype-based representations of the data. So let me stop here, and I'd like to conclude by saying that I have presented two main results. The first result is the duality between associative memory models and feedforward neural nets. The reason why this duality is important is because it makes it possible to bring in the notion of the energy function for analyzing computational properties of feedforward neural nets. Energy function is a natural quantity that exists in the associative memory formulation, but normally does not exist in feedforward neural nets. And this duality makes it possible to bridge this gap. Second, if we forget everything that I have said about associative memories and focus exclusively on feedforward neural nets, then we are still left with the following results. For the activation functions that grow slowly, the corresponding feedforward neural net extract features from the data. But as the activation function becomes steeper and steeper, the neural net gradually enters the prototype regime. Of course, we can take this logic to the extreme and say, you know, why don't we try huge powers, for example, n equals 100. At some point along this logic, we'll hit a point when our neural net will become very stupid and will simply do nearest neighbor classification. We know that that's not the right thing to do, and we don't want to go quite that far. However, what is important is that there is a broad range of powers of these activation functions for which the neural network is already far away from the feature matching mode and is already sufficiently deep inside the prototype regime, but is still very far away from the nearest neighbor classification regime. And that is the computational regime that we are interested in. And to the best of my knowledge so far, it remains very poorly investigated. Thank you.
So, two questions. What corresponds to the number of layers in the deep learning network in your correspondence? And secondly, in this correspondence, the connections between layers are the same, aren't they?
So the correspondence that I have presented, so let me show you this slide. So in principle, associative memory is a recurrent neural net. And however, you can restrict the number of updates to certain, you know, fixed number. If you restrict it to one step update, like we did in this MNIST experiment, then you get, in the dual description, you will get a feedforward neural net with one layer. If you restrict it to two steps update, then you will have the feedforward neural net with two layers. And yes, the answer to your next question, of course, if we do that, then the weights will be shared.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
If I consider the case with additive noise in your inputs, won't there be any problems with activation functions that have rather large n, because the noise would be amplified by the factor of n?
Well, it's actually the other way around. It turns out that these networks are more robust to noise than rectified linear units.
Assume that you actually try this network as a single layer.
Sorry,
over here,
on your
right-hand side.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How does the capacity of this network scales with n? Have you guys tried this out? Because you can think of the, you know, if you let n grow, the activation function becomes something like a step function, right?
Yes, exactly. But again, you don't want to go to the point when n is equal to infinity, because if you do that, then it will be nearest neighbor classification. It won't be like a particularly good framework.
So following up, do you have a feeling of how the capacity would scale in that case?
So by capacity, do you mean the capacity of the associative memory, or you mean something else?
Yeah.
So the capacity of associative memory scales like is shown here. It scales like capital N to the power N minus 1. So capital N is the number of the neurons that the neural network has, and little n is the power of the energy function. And if you want to think about in terms of feedforward neural nets, then the corresponding activation function will have the power N minus 1.
I have a question regarding your MNIST classification. So you had labeled units for the inside of the Hopfield net, right? Did I understand it correctly?
Well, I would say that in the language of the Hopfield net, you have memories. And the dictionary that translates the language of the Hopfield net to feed-forward neural nets is the following, that the memories will correspond to hidden units in the feed-forward formulation.
No, let's assume the simplest case here. You had this Hopfield net with higher order interactions, right?
Okay.
And they have more complicated attractors. That's the message here, right?
Well,
and you can code more memories in
yes.
this Hopfield net.
Right.
So my question is, in this framework, I mean, the whole soul of Hopfield networks is that, you know, the memory of something is the prototype, right? So if I want to recognize one, I give it to the Hopfield net, and it gives me a one, and which is good, right?
Yes, and
so
you can
there,
see
there are no labeled units, basically. You know, there is no error back propagation. You know, you're not.
Well, in yeah. traditional formulation, no, but you can easily train these nets using a backpropagation algorithm, like exactly along the lines that I have presented here.
Oh, yes, I'm not talking about the second part of your talk. On the first part of your talk, you had a Hopfield net that did classification without having...
Oh, no. In the first part, we did not do any classification. So this simulation that I showed you on the first slide was just, you know, an illustration of the statement that associative memories can complete incomplete patterns. That's all. We did not use the standard, you know, binary formulation for classification. That would not be a good classifier.
Did you test it? Did you test a Hopfield net with high order interactions as a Hopfield net? What does it do in classification?
Well, it more or less does nearest neighbor classification. With the sufficiently large powers, and this result on the corresponding result on MNIST would be 4.5% errors, which is not particularly, you know, good result.
But don't you find it surprising because you have all these modes, right? You're
Perhaps
creating
we
more
take
modes.
Some of this discussion
okay.
offline. We have time for one more question.
Okay, this is super interesting. Your MNIST results there, could you go back to the table just to make sure that my question is correct?
Please stop me when I need to stop.
The results table. Yeah, here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I see here that, okay, you seem to have an optimum by N equal 3, but the more prototype-y the features get, the worse the classification rates get here. Is this an... artifact of this particular task, or do you think this like a general statement?
So, well, there are sort of two questions in your one question. So, in principle, you can use the power of the activation function as a hyperparameter, and you can have a validation set, and you can tune it on the validation set to achieve optimal accuracy. We did this in this simple, you know, set of experiments, and indeed we discovered that the rectified parabola as an activation function is a little bit better activation function than a rectified linear unit. However, the statement that I would like to emphasize in regard to these results is that I would like to think about all these numbers as being all in the 1.5% range. I mean, I think more work is required to be able to say, you know, how they behave as a function of n. However, what we do understand, and I've already said this in response to one of the previous questions, that if n is very large, say equals 100, then this network is doing nearest neighbor classification. We understand this both theoretically and we can experimentally validate it. And if we are in that regime, then the classification accuracy is terrible. So it will be 4.5% or something like that. And so it's important to keep n large but finite.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you, everyone. Let's thank the speaker again. And this concludes the morning session, and we're going to reconvene for the symposium after lunch.